This is 90.9 FM, WDCB, The Real Deal with Orbert Davis, and we're doing what we do each and every Friday night, and I am just so excited that we get to have this segment that we call Sitting In. Back in the old days, we used to just get together and play and sit in, and I'd like to expand that concept into all things jazz, and tonight, I am just so thrilled to have Ricky Riccardi. I said that right. We just spent a half hour laughing. I said Riccardi. Okay. Right. So Ricky is, tell us about yourself, especially your title. This is so interesting.
I'm the director of research collections for the Louis Armstrong House Museum in Queens, New York.
Queens, New York.
Fancy way of saying archivist.
Wow. But this is the actual home that Louis lived in.
So Louis and Lucille Armstrong moved to Queens in 1943. Louis died at home in 71. His wife Lucille died in 83. No one really knew this, but Louis was kind of a hoarder. And he was making scrapbooks. He was making reel-to-reel tapes. He was saving big band arrangements, his library, his record collection. And so after Lucille died, there was a deal struck between the Armstrong Foundation and the City of New York and Queens College. The Queens College would administer everything. So step one, all of Louis's personal belongings were taken out of the house, brought to Queens College, and that became the Louis Armstrong Archives. So that opened up in 1994, and when it opened, it only had Louis's stuff, which is tremendous. I mean, trumpets, mouthpieces, I mentioned the tapes, all that kind of stuff. We made the decision to continue collecting. So now we have 13 separate collections, all Armstrong. That's the only thing we collect. It's become the world's largest archives for any single jazz musician. So that's still at Queens College, and that's what I'm in charge of. But the actual Armstrong House, which was about 10 minutes away, that opened up as a museum in 2003. So people have been coming from around the world. And so where we're heading now, we've raised $23 million. We're building the Armstrong Center, which construction is ongoing as we speak. Mm-hmm. I don't want to jinx it, but we could be in there by the end of this year. We'll see. I've been saying that for about 8 years. Right? But the construction's going on. And what that's going to be, all the archives will move into the new center, which is going to be right across the street from the house.
Okay, that's
So the plan in a year or so is you'll be able to come to 107th Street in Corona, Queens, see the Armstrong House, take a tour of it. Nothing's changed. Everything's 100% original. And then go across the street to the new building, and there'll be interactive experiences. Sure. There'll be exhibit space. The archives will be there. I'll be there. There'll be a 70-seat jazz club. We'll have live concerts and seminars and film screenings and all that stuff. So our little version of what Elvis has with Graceland, we'll have for Armstrong.
Oh, my goodness. Well, here's what can be considered a dumb question, because we all know the answer, but I think I want you to answer, why Louis Armstrong?
Why not? I mean, to me, Louis Armstrong, he is the 20th century. Yeah, a lot of people just get fixated on the trumpet playing. Some people just get fixated on the gravelly voice and What a Wonderful World. But we're talking about one individual who completely changed the way people played music on their instruments. He completely changed the way people sang. I mean, that alone, you can think of all the great singers, you think of all the great instrumentalists, but to actually change like both directions. Yeah. I mean, that alone. And then there's the story, growing up in New Orleans, getting arrested, dealing with poverty, racism, getting out of it. Then a whole life, he's a civil rights pioneer. He's breaking down barriers. He's telling off the government during Little Rock. And, one thing after another, appears in 30 films, hit records in every decade, published two autobiographies. I mean, so when you think about that whole thing, it's like that man did it all. Anything that happened, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, right up to hip hop or anything, you can kind of trace back to his sense of rhythm, his sense of swing.
Yeah.
And so the fact that he was his own curator, that he was making these reel-to-reel tapes, that he was amassing scrapbooks, to me, that was a sign that he knew he was going to be important. He was important. Sure. His trombone player, Trummy Young, Trummy's daughter, Andrea, visited me about a year ago, and she said, anytime he went to Chicago, he would always stay at the Palmer House, and it said the word would get out, and there would be a bread line around the corner. People knew Louis was there. And so he would come off the elevator and people would just hit him. Oh, man, Pops, I haven't worked in 6 months. And he would just walk smiling, just giving out 20s, giving out 50s. Goodness. And so his manager got wind of this, Joe Glazer. Joe Glazer said, what are you doing? You're going to give all your money away. And Lewis said, what do I need money for? They're going to write about me in the history books one day. And so it's that. That's one of my favorite stories. My other one, we have a tape that's not quite fit for radio. Okay. But we have a tape where Lewis and Lucille get into a vicious argument. It's like 5 o'clock in the morning, and they're going at it. Oh, and she doesn't know he's tape recording. And when she finds out, when she discovers it, she calls him out. She starts cursing him off, and she tells him, erase that tape. And he says, no, it's for posterity. And so to me, that's it. And so better thing? This is a guy. He's so humble. He's so down home. He's so approachable. He's so natural. But he also knows what he's overcome. He knows what he's accomplished. He knows people are going to write about him one day. Why not be in control of your own story?
Love it.
So he's making these tapes where you hear him let his guard down. You hear him cursing. You hear him venting about race. You hear him talking about other musicians. But then you also hear him interacting with fans and being the life of the party and all this stuff. So for me, I was born 9 years after he died. Right. I never got to meet him. I got the bug when I was 15 years old, and I immediately gravitated toward his music from the 50s and 60s. Louis Armstrong plays W.C. Handy, and Satch plays Fats, Ambassador Satch. That stuff was just like a wake-up call.
Right.
So I began reading about Armstrong, and every book I gravitated towards had the same narrative. No, don't listen to that. In the 1920s, the man is an innovator, but then after that, he's a clown, he's a showman, I'm sitting there saying, I don't buy this. So I began getting the pipe dream. You know what? Lewis was great in every decade of his career. You know, the qualities of a genius don't just go away one day. And I said, people are sleeping on these later years. Somebody should write a book about this latter period of Armstrong's life. So I ended up going to Rutgers, and I got a master's in jazz history and research. And I wrote a 350-page thesis on just the last 25 years of Armstrong's life. And it was unfinished, too. I had 10 more years to go. But my mentor was Lewis Porter, and he said, save it for the book. I wrote that thesis, and I interviewed every surviving musician I could find. I did all the newspaper research. I talked to producers and friends and fans. The one thing I was missing was Armstrong. So in January 2006, I began going to the Armstrong Archives as a researcher. I wasn't even working there yet. Yeah. And the very first thing I did, I said, I want to hear one of these private tapes. And they're like, which one do you want to hear? I said, how many do you have? I said, about 650. Boy. And so they handed me this giant binder, and I'm leafing through the binders, all descriptions. And I only got two or three pages in. I'm like, let me play this one. It says, interview 1956. And there is Armstrong in his hotel room in 1956. And he basically gave the whole thesis of my book in his own words, saying that he was playing better than ever, and this about critics and about this. And I'm just writing it all down. And so for the next 3 years, I spent as much time as I could as a researcher there, getting his words. And so my book came out in 2011 called What a Wonderful World, The Magic of Louis Armstrong's Later Years. And so I was able to finally shine a spotlight. But what's most gratifying for me is I was able to mostly lean on himself. Let him defend himself. Let him explain himself. You could still disagree with some of his stances and some of his choices, but so many writers had just spent so much space trying to psychoanalyze him, trying to get, who is the real Louis Armstrong? Why did he do this? He did it for us. You don't need to be a psychoanalyst to get there.
Well, how did this then become a job? So you're there, everyone's noticing, he's here again.
In 2007, I started an Armstrong blog, which is still, I'm reviving it now. It's dippermouth.blogspot.com. Mm-hmm. And so I started the blog, which gave me enough of a reputation to come down here, New Orleans, for the first time in 2008. I was invited to come to Sachem of Summerfest, and I gave him three lectures and was really well received. But the longtime director of the Armstrong House, Michael Cogswell, was here. And then in 2009, I came back to Sachem of Summerfest, and he said, we just got a 2-year grant to hire an archivist. They had just received the Jack Bradley collection, which is the world's largest collection, private collection of Armstrong material. I knew Jack. I'd interviewed him for the book. Sure. And I never went to library school. I said, but if I'm ever going to make a living doing this, I said, this is my chance. So I filled out the application. My first letter of recommendation was from Jack Bradley, my first reference. Why not? So they did a phone interview with me, and the first half of the interview were all Armstrong questions. Yeah, tell me about Louis Armstrong in the 1920s. Name three and parts.
It's like an exam.
I said, I got this. The second half were all library questions. Yeah, what are the pitfalls of retrospective conversion? I'm sitting there on the phone. Bah, 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 bah. So I hung up the phone. I told my wife, I said, I don't know. I said, I had it for the first half, but I am no librarian. Right. But they called me in for the in-person interview, and they said, this is the Jack Bradley collection. They take me in the back, and it's just boxes and boxes and boxes of stuff. And Michael opened up one box, and he pulled out, Jack was a photographer, and he pulled out a stack of contact sheets and negatives. Man. And he said, this is what you're going to be working with. And I took one look at the contact sheet, and it was like the movie Rain Man. I took one look, and I'm like, well, that's a Mercury recording session from the fall of 1964. And so the whole search committee, they're looking at it. There's nothing was written.
No reference,
they're like,
yeah.
How do you know? I said, it's Big Chief Moore on trombone. It's Eddie Shue on clarinet.
Man, good for you.
That edition of Armstrong's band was only together for 6 months. In those 6 months, they made two record dates, both for Mercury in October and November of 64. That's a recording studio. It has to be one of those. And about 2 hours later, they said, you got the job.
Got the job. Well, I mean, who else could do the job?
Yeah.
That is, so, that's amazing.
I had a very narrow path. The one thing I left out here is those 4 years, I graduated in 05, and I started working at the Armstrong Archives in 09. I was a house painter with a master's degree. My father was a painting contractor.
Oh,
and so
okay.
I graduated in May of 05. I got married in June of 05. And I said, I'll help the old man out until I get a gig. And so for 4 years, it was, I couldn't get a gig. I had an agent, but the book was getting rejected. My wife was starting to sweat. And my parents were like, you know, my dad, I didn't put you to school to be a painter. And then it was, you know, hard work and dedication. It was all like dominoes. All of a sudden, wow. Getting invited to New Orleans, getting the book deal, getting the job, and now I'm all Armstrong all the time.
Yeah, and this is it. I mean, I can't imagine what else you would
want to do. I hit my peak at 30.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm 39 now. But I have found other ways. Yeah, this is a particularly exciting year coming up. I've somehow gotten into the world of CD producing and album reissues. And
awesome.
So I've done a ton of stuff for Universal, for Dot Time Records, unissued Armstrong recordings. And with Mosaic Records, we made a deal with Sony. We're putting out a 7-CD box set that will be out hopefully by the summer. We've pretty much finished it. But it's all Armstrong 46 to 66 studio recordings. Louis Armstrong plays W.C. Handy, Satch plays Fats, The Real Ambassadors, Mac the Knife Session. An hour to 80 minutes of alternate takes on each disc, just stuff that's never been heard before. And so for me, it's a trip because that's the stuff that changed my life.
Yeah.
And now I'm in charge of this.
Of putting it together.
This thing. And then my second book is coming out in September. They actually just sent me a preliminary cover design this morning. So it's an exciting day. This one, it's about Armstrong.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm one trick pony. But the first book came out in 2011. And I was so hell-bent on getting people to take the later years seriously that when the book came out, I said, well, my work's done. I've been able to produce these CDs, give lectures. What more is there? And people would say, what's your next book? What's your next book? I don't need another book. What's going on? But then I would go out. I would give lectures. I would talk to students. I would do master classes and stuff. And I realized that nobody was paying attention to his big band either. You know,
right.
In a lot of jazz education circles, Lewis basically dies in 1928.
Right.
The wax dries on West End
That's
blues.
True. That's
and they're
true.
Like, well, why go on? And a lot of jazz students, that's all they get. And I will never say a bad word. Yeah, the hot fives, not sevens. That's why we're here today.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, all of a sudden, I realized, well, let's check out these big band years. Because again, to hear him tell it, you know, those were his favorite recordings. Let's look at the barriers he's breaking, appearing in movies and what he's dealing with
with
race. And the flow of his career, arrested for marijuana, gangsters are holding him at gunpoint, he blows out his chops, can't play for 6 months. I said, there's a hell of a story here.
That's right.
And so Oxford University Press, and they grabbed onto it, and I submitted it. It's in production, and that should be out. It's going to be called Heart Full of Rhythm, The Big Band Years of Louis Armstrong. And so I never envisioned doing the Star Wars style, but but somehow.
But you know what? And you mentioned Star Wars. As you're saying this, I can picture movie material. Because again, it's almost undiscovered because the story's not told.
Exactly.
One of the things when I taught jazz history at the college level was I presented Louis Armstrong as the artist of the century, of more than one century, but also in terms of his photography. When you think of being a subject.
Oh my God.
From, you know, being African-American, but being the subject of so many amazing images throughout his whole career. And when you look at, again, like you said earlier, his upbringing, but you look at his personality that shines in every picture.
Oh, my goodness.
Especially in the interaction with other people.
Oh, we have thousands of photos. And so one thing, this was never officially part of my job, but I kind of just grew into it. And now I love it. I run all the social media for the Louis Armstrong House. So follow us on Instagram, Twitter,
I will.
Facebook. Yeah. But I try to get every day. It's tough sometimes, but we have so many images of Armstrong, and people just still respond. And we have photos of him smiling. We have photos of him frowning, photos of him with celebrities, with musicians, with fans,
kids,
color photos, black and white photos. We have thousands. And it's easier now than ever. I should also talk about this. About 4 years ago, 5 years ago, we were visited by Robert F. Smith, the wealthiest African-American in the world, paid for the Morehouse College loans. He is a huge Armstrong fan. And we wake up every day looking for grant opportunities. And he came to us. So I was like, tell me about what you do.
Man.
And so we rolled out the red carpet. And he ended up giving us $2.7 million to digitize the entire collection.
Wow.
So it was about a 2-3 year process. My entire staff is me and the full-time archivist, Sarah Rose. That was it, about two of us. But the grant money paid for other vendors and outside sources. And so we ended up digitizing every photograph, every reel-to-reel tape, every scrapbook page, and we made it available. About a year ago, we went live on our website. It's collections.louisarmstronghouse.org. And if you go there, you click login, then register. You can create an account. It's a free account. And you can listen to every one of his tapes. You can watch every video we have. Oh, you can, you know, it's not there for downloading. All the videos have watermarks. All the audio has little subliminal beeps every 30 seconds, so nothing can be commercialized. But for research purposes, for young musicians, for anybody, we still want people to come to Queens, obviously. But this was our kind of gift to the world that you can be in New Orleans, you can be in Chicago, you could be anywhere, and be able to access everything we have in these archives.
Well, I'm sold. I will be there. That is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, like we were saying, this could have been anybody's collection, you know, but the fact that Armstrong, you know, the man of the century, this towering figure, the fact that he is the one collecting this stuff, and we've been able to digitize his collection, it's a dream come true.
Okay, well, I just totally forgot that this is a radio show, and I think we should... this is a hard question. If you were to pick one piece right now that everyone needs to hear, what would it be?
Stardust. That's it. Stardust from November 4th, 1931.
All right. Well, let's play that right now. This is a radio show, folks. This is The Real Deal with Orbert Davis on 90.9 FM WDCB. And here is Louis Armstrong, Stardust.
Wonder why I spend such lonely nights. Oh, baby, lonely nights. Dreaming of a song, melody, memory. And I'm once again with you. When our love was new, oh, baby. Each kiss an inspiration. Now that, baby, you know, long ago. Garden wall, when stars are bright and you are in my arms, baby, the nightingale tells its fairy tale. a paradise
where roses bloom. Though I dream in vain, in my heart it will remain, baby, my start of melody. Oh, memory, oh, memory, oh, memory.
While the music playing, we're absolutely going crazy about Louis Armstrong. Oh my goodness. And another thing I used to talk about a lot was just the American sense of style.
Yeah.
You know, in the pictures, of course, because man, when he wore a suit, he wore
sharp,
the suit.
Yeah.
But then it's just his persona. And, you know, he called everybody Pops, or he always had the name, and it was always this, just coolness. And America wasn't cool during that time.
No. I mean, there's a string of records. Stardust is one of them. But actually, I write about this in my next book. There's a string of records he makes in November of 31. Chinatown, Lazy River, Stardust, I Got Rhythm, George on My Mind, You Can Depend on Me, one after another. And you listen, I mean, the trumpet playing is mind-blowing.
Right.
But every recording is just dripping with slang. And like, these are pop records, and he's calling everybody cats, and he's doing all these things. And it's like he's teaching America to be cool.
Right.
One of my favorite things I do with students, you know, when I first got into this, you know, I was so immersed in Armstrong that I would get hired for the occasion. Oh, a class is coming in, or it could be musicians, could be not be musicians. But I'd be like, here's Potato Head Blues. Isn't this great? And I'd play him. Not realizing that 21st century, you know, no one plays instruments anymore, sadly. And right. Yeah, they wouldn't know a good trumpet solo, especially a 1927 trumpet solo. Right. So then people were kind of looking bored, and I'm like, oh, something's wrong here. And then I realized that context was the key. And thanks to the glorious internet, one of my favorite things, you can find regular dance band pop white versions of a lot of the same songs Armstrong recorded, recorded at the same period. This is where my next book starts. In 1929, OK Records, they realized that the Hot Fives and Sevens were selling, you know, they were race records, right, aimed at urban communities, but they noticed these records are selling, people are responding to what this Armstrong does, and they switched him over to the pop side, and they started giving him the pop songs of the day. And so I Can't Give You Anything But Love was the first one.
Oh, right.
And then after that, you get Ain't Misbehaving and Black and Blue and After You've Gone, When You're Smiling, and then Song of the Islands. And then right on through Body and Soul and All of Me and you know, Stardust and I Got Rhythm. All the songs that everyone still plays today, he put those songs on the map. But like I said, that's not enough. So what I like to do is I like to search those songs up on YouTube and find other contemporary versions.
Right.
Because a lot of young trained ears, they're hearing the stuff through Freddie Hubbard and through Chick Corea and so it's
Miles.
All that stuff. When you hear, it's like, okay, this is the way people were playing Body and Soul in 1930.
Exactly.
And now Armstrong's record is released on a pop label at the same time.
Yeah.
It's like from another planet.
And what's amazing is that the arrangements are pretty much the same.
The same. Stock arrangements.
That's the style.
Yep.
But then you get this, you know, this man who's like taking the beat way back here. And that second chorus of Up the Lazy River. Up the Lazy River.
It's bebop.
Right.
Yeah. And that's all you need. I mean, the melody of Lazy River. Yeah. It's like this up and down sing-song thing. And he just boils it down to one pitch,
it
just relaxed. And so that's when I give a lot of lectures and all. That's what I try to get my audiences to kind of get back into you know, you need to feel the impact of what this must have sounded like the day it arrived.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, you listen to, you know, in the summer of 1930, he records, "I'm Confessing That I Love You," mm-hmm. and then "If I Could Be With You 1 Hour Tonight." And if you listen to the white versions from that summer, they're you know, it's all toothpaste and smiles and very, you know, glee club. And, you know, "If I Could Be With You 1 Hour." And, you know, it's very corny, very dated. And he does both of those, slows down the tempo. And again, 1930, African American, and he's on pop music, yeah, okay, his pop label.
Right.
You know, "If I Could Be With You 1 Hour Tonight," if I were free to do the things I might, you know, but he is throwing, and he's, you know, he's insinuating, he's throwing in those babies, and he's moaning, and he's a whole style of passion that's not there in American pop singing. And
right.
then he is now showing us, like, this is how you sing a ballad. This is how you convey
right.
passion. And, you know, like I said, you can listen to anything today. We're still basically singing. People are still throwing babies in.
Yeah,
people are still moaning. It's all there.
Wow. It'd be interesting to talk about influence. I was very fortunate to befriend Rex Stewart's daughter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Regina Frazier. Oh. Very good friend of this in Chicago when she was alive. And, you know, I would talk for hours just about Rex. And she would always talk about how Louis Armstrong just influenced him.
Yeah.
And that was it, the second trip to New York where everybody copied Louis. Just
the way he walked.
The boots, everything.
Yeah, the thick-soled shoes.
Right,
the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, that's... Mesmer also has a beautiful passage about Armstrong in Harlem around 29:30. Every kid was dressing like him.
Yeah.
He would sway when he stood there. They would sway when they stood there. You know, he basically introduced marijuana. There's an article from the early 30s saying, you know, the marijuana craze was brought into Harlem by jazz musician Louis Armstrong.
So,
he was ahead of his time in every way.
Well, our state just legalized it.
That's
so
what I'm saying.
That'd be some lessons from Louis.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's more than just the trumpet playing, you know.
Yeah.
And like I said, the trumpet playing speaks for itself.
Yeah.
But a lot of young musicians who are just trying to figure out the notes and what do I play over this chord and all that stuff. You know, once you dig into Armstrong and you see the offstage and you see the man, you listen to the vocals, listen to the slang, listen to how he carried himself, look at the photos, you know, you realize that there's nothing else like this.
This is great. My question is, what about the video Umbrella Man?
Oh, yeah.
With Louis and Diz.
Diz, yeah. So see, Dizzy and Louis, this was a very interesting relationship because the two of them are more similar than I think either of them wanted to admit.
Right.
But bebop kind of blows up, and really the publicists were fanning that flame. Leonard Feather, a lot of critics like that. And all of a sudden, anything that happened before bebop was immediately out of date. And so Armstrong, his very first public quotes on bop were for Esquire in January 47. It's very complimentary.
Yeah.
But then they started attacking him. Dizzy actually did a blindfold test with Leonard Feather in January 47, in which he gave one star to one of the Hot 5 records, and he knocked Lewis's playing on it. You know, he had some compliments, but so all of a sudden Lewis forms the small group, the All-Stars, and this is the summer of 47, and they ask him, "Well, what do you think about this new bebop stuff?" And he just unloads, modern malice and jujitsu music, he calls it, and all this stuff. Well, Dizzy fights fire with fire. And he says, you know, Armstrong is a plantation character, and, you know, we have to get away from that square Uncle Tom beat and all that stuff.
Wow.
So the two of them are going to war. Lewis, though, he criticizes bebop. He criticizes modern jazz. He always removes Dizzy. He would always say, Dizzy's smart. Dizzy's an old fox. Dizzy learned the right way. Dizzy can play. He said, but a lot of these young kids, you know, they don't know. And then in the 50s, musically, they start spoofing each other. Dizzy records Pops Is Confessing. Lewis records the Whiff and Poof song, which makes fun of bebop. And so it's like the original rap war. But to me, what changes it, Dizzy moves to Corona, Queens in around 1956. So now he's living around the corner. And his wife used to be a dancer. Lucille Armstrong used to be a dancer. They start fraternizing. So Lewis and Dizzy, they start hanging out. And Dizzy realizes, oh my goodness, you know, this guy that I've always criticized and smile and plantation image and all that stuff, this is who he is. And so Dizzy in his autobiography writes beautifully about it, how he completely misjudged him.
Yeah.
He said, that smile I had so much trouble with, He goes, that was Lewis's refusal to let anything take that smile. Nothing was going to take away his joy of performing. And Lewis, as younger men, we all misjudged him. So the two of them become friends. Then Lewis puts his whole career on the line, speaks out about Little Rock. And so now Dizzy has even more respect for him. Right. And so in 59, January 7th, 1959, they have their one and only performance. And they decided to do it on Dizzy's turf. You know, Umbrella Man was in his repertoire. He had recorded it. He had done it forever. I don't think Lewis ever played it before or after. But the results speak for itself. You know, it's all on YouTube. If you haven't seen it, I think it's the greatest piece of jazz footage of all time.
Yeah.
But what I always point out when I show it to students, neither man tries playing like the other.
Right.
They're so original, and they're such mavericks, and they're instantly identifiable. Like Dizzy starts playing, he's all over the horn, it's clean, it's beautiful. Lewis starts playing, his tone is huge, and it's so relaxed.
Yep.
And there's that spirit of originality, and you know, they're just so comfortable in who they are that it's not like, you know, you see some musicians, yeah, they might be comfortable playing bebop, but then they get a traditional gig and they don't know how to approach and also. But yeah, these guys are like, we know who we are.
And know each other too.
And know each other.
Right.
But then the topper is they sing and they scat and they break up the audience and Lewis gets a Swiss Chris plug and, you know, Dizzy pops the pee and gets the spit in Lewis's face. And Lewis says, you know, your parasol is juicy, boy. And that's the other thing I point out. Yeah. I actually just posted about this recently. Yeah, when a lot of young people get into jazz, it's Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Coltrane, and that's it.
Right.
And so they learn the music. I love them all. Not the best showman.
Right.
Nobody would say that. But Dizzy had the music and knew how to, you know, put it in. Yeah, I think it's a different sense of humor than Lewis, but he had a way of lulling the audience in. Clark Terry could do that.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of musicians sleep on Lewis, Dizzy, and Clark Terry. But if you study just those three, not only do you get kind of every, like, a harmonic way of approaching the music, you also see these tricks of the trade of how to engage an audience, how to build a set. You know, if you play a blistering bop number, how to, you know, Clark Terry might do mumbles after that. Or
exactly.
Dizzy would introduce the band and break it up a little bit. And I think when people say, you know, wow, the audience is dying. And, you know, I think a lot of musicians don't learn that stagecraft.
Right.
I was teaching at Queens College. I teach a Music of Louis Armstrong course. And I had a listening assignment and some live tracks from the 40s and 50s. And they loved the music. But one student said, you know, the way Lewis says, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, between every song, he said, that's a lost art. He goes, no one does that these days.
Right.
I'm like, well, there you go. You know, these guys came from an era where it was, you know, part show business too.
And, exactly.
And, you know, if you wanted to make a living playing this, you had to meet the audience somewhat halfway.
Exactly. Okay. So again, I totally forgot that this is a radio show. Because I am just so, I'm sitting at the edge of my seat. Okay, right now we're going to play Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald.
Oh, man.
Can't We Be Friends? And then we're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
This is 90.9 FM WDCB, The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. And here's Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, Can't We Be Friends?
I'd found the man of my dreams. Now it seems this is how the story ends. He's going to turn me down and say, can't we be friends? I thought for once it couldn't go wrong. Not for long, I can see the way this ends. He's going to turn me down and say, can't we be friends? Never again. Through with love, through with men. They play their game without shame. And who's to blame? I thought I'd found a man I could trust. What a bust. This is how the story ends. He's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends?
Yes, I thought I knew the wheat from the chaff. What a laugh. This is how the story ends. I let her turn me down. Say, can't we be friends? But that day I acted like a kid out of school. What a fool. Now I see this is the end. I let her turn me down. Say, can't we be friends? Oh, why should I care? Though she gave me the air. Why should I cry, have a sigh, and wonder why? Yes, I should have seen the single stop. What a flop. This is how the story ends. She's gonna turn me down. Say, can we be friends?
Smiling here, like our grins are as big as Satch himself. This is the real deal with Orbert Davis, and it's probably an hour ago that I last introduced the name of my guest host tonight, Ricky Riccardi, who is the director of research collections for the Louis Armstrong House Museum. And wow, this is like a class for me. But okay, we just heard Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald, Why Can't We Be Friends. Now, the first thing when I hear that ending, I have the feeling that Louis doesn't quite know what to do. He just figures out what note.
His ears were huge. And to me, that comes from the vocal quartet he had as a kid in New Orleans.
Sure.
Yeah, there's been some great research, especially by a man named Vic Hobson, about the impact of barbershop quartets on Armstrong. And he rarely talked about music, but there was one interview they asked him about improvisation. And he just said it's like singing in a quartet, because the four voices have to blend. Somebody might have the melody, then you have to sing a counter melody, right, and the whole thing. So to me, the glory of those recordings of Ella Fitzgerald, they're so spontaneous. You know, that album, Ella and Louis, was recorded in one session.
No.
And that would be unthinkable nowadays. And so you get Ella, you get Louis, you get Oscar Peterson, Ray Brown, Herb Ellis, Buddy Rich. They have one day off. And they knock off 11 songs.
So no rehearsal. That's what I could tell.
They were basically picking the songs, picking the keys, and then trying. And some of those, like The Nearness of You, some of those are first takes.
Yeah.
Can't We Be Friends? I don't know if it was first take, but it was early on.
Sure.
But, you know, it's the kind of thing Norman Granz knew he didn't have time to iron it out, or let's do another take, or let's work on that ending. So, there are times where Louis doesn't quite know, are we ending it now, or how are we going to do this? But he finds that, even if it's just shouting, oh, yeah, he's going to get you to do
it. I was going to say that, at the end.
Yeah.
If Louis does that, that's it.
That's it, yeah.
But then there's all the modulations, some are kind of quirky.
Oh, yeah.
Because Louis and Ella do not necessarily sing the same key.
No, that's Oscar Peterson.
He tied it together.
Yeah. And, Ella had the wider range, so they tended to defer to Lewis's key. But especially on their second album, there's some really neat, you know, I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm. Every chorus is in a different key. Then finally they harmonize at the end. But, you know, they just came up with all that stuff on the spot. It's unbelievable.
Okay, so we have to have a real deal retreat to Queens, New York.
Say the word.
Who's with me? We'll just go there and spend a couple of days at the House Museum.
Yeah. This is,
well, there's so much more we could talk about. I am just elated. I don't know what else to say. This is like a class for me. Wow. Wow. Okay, we talked about the future, the building of the across the street. You said it's going to be the housing of the archives.
And, the archives will move right there.
Yeah. So what's your vision for the future?
Oh, my ideal vision is a future where everybody knows Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
I do feel like we're kind of at the beginning. When he died in 1971 and you read some of those obituaries, it's the stuff I talked about early on.
Right.
You know, we remember Louis Armstrong. Yes, he was an ambassador, an icon. But boy, he wasted his talent. And boy, don't, you know, let this be a lesson to you that if you give in to commercial demands, you know, all this kind of stuff. And that was the line of thinking for a while. There was a book that came out in 83. I won't give the name of it, but it's one of the most mean-spirited books. And I found reviews when it came out. People were like, yep, that makes sense. Gary Giddens was the first person to have access to the material that was in the house. And so he was the first person to kind of let Lewis defend himself.
Yeah.
His book, Satchmo, came out, and all of a sudden that
right.
started changing people's minds. At the same time, you have Winton. Winton is now talking about Lewis, starts changing people's minds.
Right.
We open up in 94. More books come out. Ken Burns' jazz documentary, For All of Its Flaws, Lewis is the star, and that changed a lot of people's minds. So now, again, you know, I'm doing my work, and, you know, we talked about today, you know, there's books coming out about the real ambassadors, Dave Brubeck, and I've got this box set coming out, another book coming out. There, Ron Howard made a deal with the Armstrong Estate. He's going to be doing a theatrical documentary like he just did Pavarotti. He's going to do one on Armstrong. So I feel like, you know, it's going to be 50 years since he died next year. And now we're kind of like, we now understand the man. We understand how big he was, how important he was. Given another 50 years, I do think, you know, he will be part of the history curriculum. And they're going to say, you know, everyone's going to know Shakespeare. Everyone's going to know, you know, Mozart. And everyone's going to know Louis Armstrong.
It's about time.
And, you know, we're not quite there yet, but my nephews who are in high school, you know, they're like, hey, we learned about Louis Armstrong in school today. I'm like, good. School groups are, you know, we get a ton of international visitors to the Armstrong House, but I would say school groups are probably our number one thing. Every day, two groups a day, four days a week, you know, all ages coming, and we give them the whole spiel, and they, you know, and it sinks in because that story, you know, he is so approachable, but you know, you get the rags to riches story. And then when you take a tour of the Armstrong House, we play his music throughout.
Right.
And so the fact that this building is going to open up and we are going to have all this programming and there will be movies and there will be books and all this kind of stuff. You know, have me back on in 50 years and I'll say, you know, see ya, I told you so.
Oh, that's awesome. Wow, this is cool. So we have time for one more, Ricky. I want you to pick it and you be the DJ. Just
all right.
Set it up.
One thing we've kind of danced around today is Armstrong's smile, Armstrong's positivity. This is the way he just radiated warmth, how natural he was. And so I think probably the most autobiographical song in that vein is When You're Smiling. And he originally recorded it in 1929. It's a spectacular version. He plays the melody up an octave. It was very influential at the time. But in 1956, he revisited it. He did a project called Satchmo, a Musical Autobiography, where he went back and remade 43 songs he originally recorded between 1923 and 34. And so to me, it's the definitive document of Armstrong's powers in the 50s. Sure. And musicians like Ruby Braff was with Armstrong when he was preparing it. And he said that Armstrong, it was like training for a championship fight. He would listen to all those records from the 20s and be like, tempo was too fast. You know, I should have played the melody more. And so he went into the studio. Milt Gabler was the producer. He made sure Armstrong had no other bookings. He made sure the sessions were tight. He had food. He had drinks. He invited friends. And what Lewis does on this album is just out of this world. But to me, the When You're Smiling at a dangerously slow tempo, the vocal just radiates warmth. And then he picks up the horn. And you know, if you're not sobbing by the end, you're not human.
That's awesome. But here it is, When You're Smiling, Louis Armstrong. And I'll be smiling for a long time. Thank you so much, Ricky.
Oh, thank you. I had a ball.
All right. My guest host for this segment, Ricky Riccardi, the Director of Research Collections for the Louis Armstrong House Museum in Queens, New York. And I will be there soon.
Good deal. I'll see you there.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby, baby. Yes, when you're laughing. When you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. So stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby, and I hope.
Smiling. And Louis got me smiling. Hey, since we talked about Lazy River with Ricky Riccardi, let's check it out. Here's Louis Armstrong from 1931, Lazy River.
Yeah. way down, way down.
I lay the river where old mill run. Meet the lazy river with the noonday sun. Linger in the shade of a kind old tree.
Throw away your trouble, dream a dream of me, dream a dream of me.
Up the lazy river where the robin's on. Wakes to bright new morning
as we loaf along.
Blue skies up above, everyone in love. Up the lazy river, how happy we will be.
Mama, mama.
Oh, up the lazy river, up the lazy river,
Oh, you dog. Boy, if I ain't ripping this evening, I hope something.
Oh, of the lazy river. River. Oh, you river.
Oh, you dog.
Oh, you river.
Look out there, Charlie Alexander. Swing out there on them irons there, boy.
there goes Mac the Knife. The shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them a pearly white. Just a jackknife has Mac Heat, dear, and he keeps it out of sight. When the shark bites with his teeth, dear, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, where's Mac Heat, dear? So there's not a trace of red. On the sidewalk, Sunday morning, baby, lies a body oozing life. Someone sneaking around the corner. Is this someone, Mac the Knife, from a tugboat by the river, a cement bag's drooping down. Yes, the cement's just for the weight, dear. Bet you Mac he's back in town. Look a year, Louis Miller disappeared, dear, after drawing out his cash. And Mac Heat spends like a sailor. Did our boy do something rash? Suki Tawdry, Jenny Diver, Lottie Lanier, Sweet Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms on the right, dears. Now that Mac Heat's back in town.
Take it, Satch.
Wow, Louis Armstrong right here on The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. That was Mac the Knife. Before Mac the Knife, the classic West End Blues, 1928. Wow. Hey, stick around. Third hour, we're going to New Orleans for a whole hour of post-Fat Tuesday. I guess we can call it Fat Friday or Diet Friday. See you in a minute.